Go ahead.
Okay. Today is, excuse me for a second here, the conference call for the Courtroom Observers Committee for August 23rd, 2017. I'm sure there's a lot of talk about tonight with regard to the acquittal of the Patriots in the Bunkerville trial, but I don't know all that much about it. I think that's pretty much Robert's domain, so if he'd like to say anything about that, we'd appreciate it.
Yeah, I think we will talk about that a little bit. Now, there were four defendants on trial, and it was a retrial because of a hung jury on the last one. Now, in this trial, the judge tried to set it up to where, you know, it stacked the jury, stacked everything against the defendants, and every one of the witnesses for the prosecution was law enforcement. And the judge made the ruling that because they were all law enforcement, that the defendants did not have the right to defend themselves against law enforcement. Now, she also, at the time that the defense part of the trial began, she made the rule that all defense witnesses had to go over with her what they would say. And when this was done, she ruled it all irrelevant and denied those witnesses to be on the stand. So the only witnesses then were the defendants themselves. One of the defendants was called to the stand and immediately said something that the judge didn't like, and they drug him off the stand, and they erased his comments and would not let him give testimony any further. Well, then one other defendant was able to speak, barely, and there was two that were not allowed, or three not allowed to be on the record. Now, the jury asked the judge when they were going to see the defense witnesses or see their evidence, and the judge told the jury that they weren't going to see any evidence from the defense because they had none. Well, then this past Monday, after having been deliberating for a while, they had questions. We don't know what those questions were because the judge would not read aloud. But also, the foreman of the jury brought up two jurors who were refusing to participate in the deliberations. And I come to find out from questioning by prosecution, the defense lawyers, and the judge that they had not been truthful on their forms they filled out as a juror. One of them was had an incident with a gun at a young age, which still was affecting her, and so she's afraid of guns. This other had been an officer of the court for 18 years and had not admitted to that prior to being selected. But the judge decided it was all irrelevant, it was okay, and she wanted them on the jury and sent them back and to deliberate some more. And they had a partial decision. Told the judge they did. Brought them into the courtroom, and the judge sent them back to deliberate some more. And then they told the judge that they were hopelessly deadlocked. And so yesterday they came out, and on two of the defendants, there were 40 charges on these four defendants, and on two, they had them innocent across the board. The other two, one of them had, well, they were deadlocked on six charges against one and two on the other. And they said they were going to release the two that were declared innocent within an hour or two, and that they were going to hold the other two until today, actually, to make a decision on whether to a retrial on the deadlocked charges. Now, they were transferred to a halfway house from the court, and when the door opened, all four of them walked out. But the word I'm getting today is, yeah, the two that still have deadlock charges can go home if they meet stringent conditions. But the judge said they'd have a retrial. Now that retrial is, as I understand, scheduled for the 25th of September. Which means that the next group that was scheduled for the 18th will once again be pushed back. I don't think this is over as far as this trial. I think there's going to be more come out. I can't see them. These charges, their main charges were conspiracy count one, conspiracy count two, and they were all found innocent of those charges. There were minor charges that they were deadlocked on. If not for the biased jurors, the two that were questioned, it would have been not guilty across the board for all of them, is how we feel. So that's where we stand. Right now, we're looking at a possible retrial on those two people. Another $1 million down the drain. Now, we didn't have, you know, we had a lot of people there supporting the guys, and the courtrooms were full, but they were not actual courtroom observers. I mean, they were courtroom observers, but they had not been in training for courtroom observing with them. So they were dressed in t-shirts and that kind of thing. And the judge felt like she could just be very open with all the corruption, and she was. But the biggest thing is what we saw was jury nullification, because they saw through the BS. They didn't believe the judge. They didn't believe the prosecutors, because they knew in their hearts that the defense would have had a witnesses and put on a defense, and they were unable to. So they knew that they were being restricted by the judge and the prosecutors, and so they just made up their mind that that's not right. Now that's makes me feel real good that we have people still in the juries who are seeing the truth and are acting upon it and are bringing about jury nullification. Maybe part of that's due to the fact that the people outside have made up T-shirts with jury nullification printed on them, front and back. And they also had the words, no victim, no crime. And so the jury was able to see this on their way to and from the courthouse each day. Now, maybe that had effect. You can bet, at least I feel we can bet, that the jury, not believing the judge and the prosecutors, probably went home each night and looked up the laws on the internet. And maybe those T-shirts had something to do with the fact that the jury was interested in finding the truth. So that's where we stand right now. Now, you people as courtroom observers would have had a field day in the courtroom. I have to wonder if all of you had showed up at that court with badges and dressed nice and everything and clipboards, if they would have even allowed you in. And if they had, I'm willing to bet that they would not have been so open with the fraud. But it worked out because they made the jury unhappy with the answers they were getting from the judge. I don't know what to expect coming up. I tend to think that there is not going to be a retrial of those two. There were 40 charges, and 34 of them was innocent across the board. And all they had left was minor charges. I don't believe it's worthwhile holding a retrial since they lost their main charges that they were looking at. They were hoping to put these guys away for 100 years. Now, I think it would have been exciting to have been in that courtroom all through that trial and writing affidavits. I'm not sure that we'll ever see another trial like that one. I don't think there's ever been a trial so openly fraudulent ever. I think it made history. But you guys could have had a heyday writing the affidavits on that one. I really don't have anything else on that. Is there any questions about it or any discussion? Very quiet crowd.
Well, when is Mr. Bundy's trial?
Well, that's the thing. During this period of time, this trial was going on, was supposed to have been Mr. Bundy and his son's trial. They got pushed back because of the retrial, and they were rescheduled for 18 September. And now that if they have a retrial again on these two men, the Bundy boys and Mr. Bundy will be pushed back to an undetermined time.
Okay, and I'm wondering, because I've missed a lot, and so I don't want to take up a whole lot of time, but how can there be a retrial of something that's already been tried where the jury came in with a verdict? I mean, is that just part of the fraud? I guess that's
my
question.
Well, there were four defendants, but each defendant was tried separately, but together.
Okay, concurrently, but separately. Okay.
And so they had a sheet that had all the defendants' names on them and all the charges they were charged with. And through deliberation, they went through and they checked off yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, however they had it. And so 34, on 34 of the charges, it was not guilty for all of them. But there were six charges that two of the defendants were found, well, the jury was hung on them. And that's what they're determining a retrial, which is fraudulent.
Okay, yeah.
You're right about that. They should not, a hung jury should not be retried.
That's what I was
Excuse
thinking.
Me. Hey, this is, how you doing, guys? This is Jeremiah, a.k.a. Donaldson. I'm here in Northern California. I want to say this about what you just said, sir, that under general purpose government guidelines, which is the same thing as de facto guidelines, they would have authority to do whatever they wanted as long as it was a civil creature. As long as it came from a legislature which was a civil creature, they could do it. It's only until we establish our common law, right, claims that we're going to be able to, you know, it's only then when we're going to see remedy. Right now, it's just what they're doing is authorized because there's no real, true, pure common law jural societies.
Well, you're right about that, but when we're discussing what is right and what's wrong, we're talking about common law. And under common law, it would not be a retrial.
Absolutely. And so how do we fix the problem? How do we get the point across to the judge in the case, even through private letter rogatory to him from one of us on the call? Hey, look, Judge, under statutory. Go ahead.
It is only going to get done when we are successful with what we are doing, taking back the courts. Only then will we get justice.
I agree with Jeremiah, too, that what in the meantime, before we get the whole thing accomplished, I do understand exactly what you're saying, Jeremiah, because I've just been reading about that. By the way, this is Jan in Kansas. And so I understand. I mean, even there is one statute that I've just run into where it says if the legislature rules on something or makes a law about something and it goes into the administrative courts, which is what you're talking about, Jeremiah, that, I mean, if somebody's constitutional rights are violated by that court, that they have to show substantial loss and nobody else can say anything about it, and on, but I agree with Jeremiah that in the meantime, if we could possibly do something, you know, where we're protesting the fraud or something, I don't mean protesting it, but
right,
somehow making it known that, hey, we know what you just did, and you can't do that.
Well, actually,
by all means, you can protest it and make it known that you know that it's not legal. But what good is it going to do you unless we have the backing that's necessary to make the change? Now, just like you said, the legislature makes that change. Well, under the Constitution, any law that is repugnant to the Constitution is not a law. You should not have to obey it. You should not obey it. However,
right,
under the circumstances that we're in today, you don't obey it, they're going to throw you in jail because we don't have the masters yet.
Yeah.
Maybe. It's dependent on every circumstance. But let me just add this, Jan, okay, from Kansas, that the Bundys, everybody that's sitting in jail right now, they would be qualified electors if they were out of jail and allowed to actually proceed under due process. You understand? Right now,
they've been
stripped of their immunity because they are prisoners.
Uh-huh.
Other people who are living in common law societies, jural societies, have to come forward and say, you are unlawfully imprisoning, right, a common law jural society member. You see what I'm saying? In other words, when NLA comes out with the determinations, it's not enough that we have a 12 people from around the country. You have to prove loyalty. And without qualified elector status or some sort of oath of affirmation to the loyalty of the state that you're from and to to protect the laws of the United States and from foreign invasion and all that stuff, the whole entire gambit actually literally applies to you and to me when we step into public service. Do you think you're not stepping into public service when you're a jural member? When you're a member of a jury, you actually are in public service. So you,
right,
all those things apply to you that would normally bind government creatures. You see what I'm saying? That's why you can use the Constitution to defend you when you step into that role. Thank you.
Well, and Captain John on the Thursday night call, he got into that being a member of different associations was the way that he was presenting it, and that's what we are, is just what Jeremiah just described and what Robert was speaking about as well, that we already are a member of the society of people who are, I don't know what was it, electorate or jural society members?
You're a qualified elector.
Qualified elector?
Right.
I don't know the terms yet. I just know the concept, you know. And so thank you guys for that information because really, I mean, can't we go ahead and operate as a member? I mean, I don't mean today because I know that we will get thrown in jail. But, I mean, it just seems like it's a concept that we might want to build on as people that live here and are that.
Well, we, you know, everything that you guys talk about is is very true and all that. We are working toward taking back our courts, and that's the only way that we're going to get justice back is when we can take it back. And if Sessions, being an attorney general, would work with us and provide us with prosecutors where we can go after people, we will bring common law back. We will.
No.
We will make it right.
It's not going to happen unless we have standing. See, the thing about the 11th Amendment is that no state can sue another state, right? So notice what Ammon Bundy did was when he went into the standoff situation in Oregon, he wasn't suing the state. He was just one man from another state. He came in and he made a point. So he was lawful in his conduct. When we step in as qualified electors, just like Ammon Bundy did, right? The federal government has no standing because they are D.C., Washington, D.C. That's a state that's outside of the several states. It exists as a separate form of government. So therefore, what happened, right? They actually have no standing to sue any of the several states unless the state consents to be sued.
Wow.
Well, be as it may, I get the feeling, Jeremiah, that you would love to disagree with everything John Durash is trying to teach.
Oh, no. No, not everything.
So we're going to get away from this subject right now.
Sure. That's fine.
This is not talking about courtroom observing. We're talking now.
Okay, courtroom observing is good. I went into a courtroom once as an observer myself here in San Francisco, and I sat there and with my paper and my pen, and I watched as the judge drilled the so-called defendant, right, with questions such as, do you understand that you are waiving your constitutional rights? Do you understand you are waiving all your constitutional rights? And then the third one, do you understand? You finally understand, right? So she asked three times. The judge asked three times. But every time the judge was asking these questions, she was looking at me. I'm sitting in the back and I'm just taking notes and I'm not a party to the action. But she was looking at me when she's asking the questions to the defendant, right? And then looking back at the defendant again, right? She's wondering if I'm actually picking up on what she's doing. See? But because I believe that whether or not we have qualified elector status or any of that stuff, none of that matters. The fact that these judges are in a fiduciary position, they have a duty, you know, to actually follow the law. And if they can get this person in open court to waive it on the record, the venue, the whole venue argument and all that, then they're gonna actually be fine. They're not going to be punished or tarnished in their image or anything like that. They're totally protecting themselves. So, yeah, there's remedy out there for you if you want to just treat symptoms, you know, that's fine. And that's, that sounds like, you know, what when you're courtroom observing, you want to pay attention to questions that have to do with the waiving of specific liberties. So when you go to the court, make sure you listen and make eye contact also with the judge. Get eye contact and get your pen and paper in there, and also pay attention to any type of question that has to do with waiver of constitutional rights, because that's going to shock you.
Well, of course, yes, they do try to get you to waive your rights. And that is something that should be noted on an affidavit. But that's also why a defendant should always, what's the word I'm looking for? reject what they're saying, you know, always disagree with
always object. You're looking for object.
Yeah, object. Always object, unless the judge is making it in your favor.
Well, I've got one more question, Robert, about, thanks, Jeremiah. That was really good information. It was very interesting. Robert, I wondered, you know, they're doing so many, I guess they call them trials, but maybe they're really just hearings. But I've heard that they're doing so many of them by video now that the accused does not get to go before a judge, that they are stood in front of like a screen, a Skype-y type thing, and where they have their hearing there where it's not public and blah, blah, blah. You know, there's nothing to it. So if we find out that that's going on in our state or our city, and we're a courtroom observer, what would be our process to get to speak with the accused, or do we have a right to speak with the accused, like to say, well, I've got an affidavit in here. You know, I mean, I'm just asking, has anybody run into that yet?
The only time you should run into that, and I don't know if they're doing it or not, other than when it comes to a young child testifying, quite often that's what they'll do, is be by video. And that's to protect the child. But as far as an adult, I don't know whether they are doing that, but if they do, that should be something noted on an affidavit, because it's every person has a right to face their accuser.
And what do you think, the way to find that out would be whether our city or state is conducting hearings or trials that way? Would that be through the sheriff's office? Could we get disclosure?
No. You need to go to the paralegal manuals. You want to look for process and how they're going to do it and what they're going to the procedures that they have to follow, okay? Then what you need to do is you need to look at all of the paralegal manuals in your local law library, because they have them in there. They're little tiny thin books, maybe about a quarter of an inch thick. And it could be for civil or criminal or trust or any of the various issues that may come up. But if you go there, they're going to tell you step by step what procedure to follow, because, you know, it doesn't make sense. You know, the job of a paralegal is just to get the process right, put everything in order so that the lawyer can come in and then, you know, make the statement based on all the legal memos that the paralegal designed. They're going to organize, of course. The head lawyer is going to be like, hey, look, let me organize all this stuff. But as far as the video is concerned, again, that's a statute, right? That in California they have laws that say that after the initial pleading, you have to file everything electronically. Every single filing has to be electronic. So if you don't know that, most of your states are probably doing mandatory e-filing, okay? So that could be another barrier as to why people's cases aren't getting listened to or heard,
right.
or arguments are getting, you know, thrown out.
Yeah, okay.
Okay?
Yeah, it's all rigged up. It's just so bad. It's just people don't have a chance. If you get through one door, it seems like they've got another one 6 inches in front of them to slam in front of you, and you have to crawl over that one.
Absolutely.
Well, that's what we try to tell you. You know, with statutes, if they run across, if they're in court and they run across in situation where there's no statute to rule on it, then the judge makes up his own.
Yeah.
At the time, and then it's written, and all other judges then use that. So it's statutes.
Technically, what happens is the judge the judge will look out for the interest of the plaintiff if there is no legal standard for the determination, because the plaintiff has the authority to make the law, set the law of the case. That's why you always want to become the plaintiff. A counter complaint is probably appropriate in a situation where someone says you have to watch by video, that you want to file a counter complaint against the court itself, the state, right? And the prosecuting attorneys who are saying, yeah, you have to watch by video. It's not the judge doing that. The judge has no authority. They're just a mediator.
That's right.
I know the law.
I don't, but I'm learning. And this does apply to courtroom observing, something that Jeremiah just said, but I have a personal thing going that I just found out about that would be really for the courtroom observers to know this, is that it, other than the Supreme Court, and I'm not sure about federal courts, but any of the other courts, what I've found out is that they have no inherent authority to make a ruling. And what Jeremiah just said about the plaintiff is what I read and I'm reading about, is that it's the plaintiff who comes forward and gives jurisdiction to the judge to hear the case. If they don't have, it's called sufficiency of pleadings in their words, but if the plaintiff does not bring forward sufficiency of pleadings to give the judge the right, I'm saying, to hear the case, then the judge can't hear it. And that is where this is important too for us courtroom observers, or would be to be courtroom observers, is that goes into that almost every case, I'm saying that with my tongue in my cheek because it's not every case, but I'm just using that word, almost every case can be challenged on subject matter jurisdiction, and then it has to be proven on the record at the time, which I've asked questions about this before, and you guys have given me information that led me to this information that I'm sharing tonight, is that once subject matter jurisdiction is challenged, then the court has to prove on the record why they believe that they have subject matter jurisdiction. And what the courtroom observers might want to know is that when they go into a case, they know what kind of a case it is. And like what Jeremiah was saying about going and looking things up, well, you could probably do it online too, this part, is that you find out what are the elements of the case. So if it's a traffic case, the person is accused of XYZ, before you go into the courtroom to hear the, you know, case going on, you'd want to know, well, okay, there's five elements that have to be proven in order for this person.
She said that she means the elements of the statute.
Oh, I don't know what I mean, you know.
Yeah, go ahead.
The right words, but I'm still on. But anyway, so you'd want to know what are the elements, and then you would even be able to sit there as a courtroom observer and put that into your affidavit that this element was not shown. And that would,
yes.
The same way, and I'm about wound down here, but the same way with the subject matter jurisdiction, if you know as the courtroom observer what has to be before the judge would have jurisdiction, and that the plaintiff is responsible to bring that, the one bringing the case has to really kind of deem the judge with authority, then you can sit there and you can say, you could even in the affidavit, I don't know that you'd want to say I challenge the subject matter jurisdiction, but you could in your affidavit also write that subject matter jurisdiction was not met, or I don't know how it would be said, because of this factor and this factor. And then you're right there, you're writing down, and it's on the record, you know, their record, that they just convicted a person who they did not prepare and prove their case on. I yield.
That's well, right, Jan. This is Margie from Charlotte, North Carolina. How y'all doing?
What's up, y'all?
Hi, Margie.
That's right, what you just said there, Jan.
Stuff?
That's very good.
With regard to the challenging of the subject matter jurisdiction?
Yes.
Yeah, but here's something that's important for everyone to know. Did you know that you have to let them make a default judgment first before you can properly challenge subject matter jurisdiction or even personal jurisdiction?
No, didn't know that. No.
Yeah, yeah. So that's why we have appeals courts. Uh-oh, I think I just hit on a major point. Thank you, guys. The whole thing is, the whole purpose for appeals courts is that once they've made a determination as to the lawfulness of your conduct, right, if it's wrong, let's say you failed to appear and they made a default judgment, they entered judgment for you, they entered a plea on your behalf. Let's say they entered a plea on your behalf. So they did a default judgment,
right.
Didn't they?
That's illegal.
Well, it is correct. No, it's not. It's not because you're not exhibiting the capacity. You're not show. In other words, they have the right to do that because you have to wait under the due process laws of common law in according to the state. It depends on the state you're in. But you have to wait until they actually make a default judgment, okay, and then you can challenge the personal or subject matter jurisdiction. Now the problem lies in the fact that many people are being falsely imprisoned before the fact of, right? So, right, that's our main issue. So they're giving due process, but people are literally becoming victims of the, I'm not going to call it, it's a general purpose government is what it is. They're becoming victims of the general purpose government. Okay, and you know what? As you go in and watch these people operate in a courtroom setting, you're going to see exactly what I'm saying. They're operating under the guise of a general-purpose government. I yield.
Well, I wanted to say one thing, and I know Margie's trying to talk too, but I'm going to get off here as soon as I say.
I'm walking. That's why you can hear some things going on. But
I wanted to say that what I understood and what I did with a case I have is I challenged due to the way that my case was. I challenged personal jurisdiction and subject matter jurisdiction from the very beginning.
Good.
I did not, and of course they went ahead and did what all the they went through all that. But all the way through, every paper that they sent me, I sent back to them, consent denied or offer rejected or subject matter jurisdiction challenged or something like that. And maybe I shouldn't have, I probably shouldn't have, but I also sent my proof that I had already, that there was no case, there was no controversy because of what I'd already done. And so I sent my proof, you know, when I wrote for the first time consent denied, I just attached the letter that showed that there was no controversy that I had written and put a little note on it because I'm not trying to be stubborn or mean or, you know, obnoxious or anything. I just don't think that the state should have to be, you know, have a trial that there's no controversy on. Anyway, so the thing is that I do agree from what I understand, and I'm not saying I'm right, but I'm agreeing with what you said, Jeremiah. You can't bring a case against somebody before it's tried, but I do believe that you can. All the way through, you can say from the very beginning, personal jurisdiction denied, subject matter jurisdiction denied, no subject. I mean, you know what I mean? You can object all the way through. So I yield, and I'm going to get off here, and thank you, Robert, for allowing me to ask my questions and for everybody who's given me such good information, given us all such good information tonight.
Okay, thank you.
Well, this is Margie, North Carolina. Charlotte, there's just a lot to learn with all this, and you know, we're learning all the time, and how much does it cost to get a transcript? How do you get transcripts, and how much do they cost? You know, if you need to get one for a court case.
To go to the courthouse records department, and it appears
clerk of court.
Well, the only one I've dealt with as far as transcripts and all has been federal, so it's always been federal courts that I've gone to. But yeah, circuit court should go to the records department.
Because, you know, I hear John say that, you know, it's good to get the transcripts or something like that, but then how much do they cost, you know? If they're $300 or something like that, forget it. I'm not going to do it.
It appears that the cost of transcripts varies with the different courts.
Uh-huh.
It's just like here in New York, to file a case, it was costing like $400.
Yes.
Well, in Oregon, I filed a case and it cost me $5.
Really?
Yeah. So it depends on where you're at.
Well, John opened up an Article 3 common law court, correct? And so is that right?
$400? Yeah, that didn't have any bearing on it, on the cost. It was just their standard fee for filing and getting a number.
Oh, getting a docket number or getting a...
The case
what
number.
Kind of number? Case number?
Yeah.
Okay.
Margie, I have something to say on the issue.
Okay.
I went years ago to the court and... there was the court recorder, and court recorder usually is the self-employed person who had the contract with the court. And court give me her name, and I contact her, and she give me the price for the copies. And I don't remember how long it was. But it wasn't the federal court. It was like a state court, county court.
District court?
No, that was the county court. It wasn't the federal court. District court, they usually is the state court. Some states call them also district courts. But, you know, that's how I obtained my copy.
So yours was smaller. I know there's all different kind of courts. So you were in a small court, county court, and then there's state, and then there's district court, like traffic court. You know, I had these speeding tickets, but it wasn't my fault. But it's just all fraud. But I was, you know, at the wrong place at the wrong time, so I went and fought it, but didn't
look,
help.
You can also hire your own reporter, and you let them know in advance. They're going to bring your own, how they call it, stenographer or whatever.
Say that again, sir. You can always hire what?
You can hire your own, how you call those, stenographer or typist who type the... But you ask the court in advance. You can bring your own. And you make the deal with her or with him, whatever.
The stenographer.
Yeah, stenographer, yeah.
And then make the deal with them before the case, right? And then how much do you charge? I think they're twenty an hour.
Yeah, the right to have the right to be sitting right there, like, no, that's just wrong. And with thousands
true.
Of other people.
True.
Yeah, so, slavery doesn't exist. Go fucking back to where you came from. You know what I'm saying? Right,
you know,
now, it's been abolished. Under the law, slavery has been abolished.
I'm sorry. Did I lose you? Hello, is anybody there?
Yeah, I'm here.
I'm here still.
Okay.
I was just talking to my friend Amos about this white nationalist
protest thing that's coming up, and they're organizing here in San Francisco a counter protest, okay, to what's happening there. And you know, I can't help but think that common law juries could help out in this scenario. If everybody had a real conceptualization of the common law, they'd really be able to see the legal effect, and they would understand the effect of their legal acts and actions, and that would mean that they had legal capacity, and therefore they could have standing, and it would be very important for everybody to embrace the common law.
Uh-huh. Hey, Jeremiah, I think you...
In addition
like,
to...
Yes?
What's that, sir?
Hello, Jeremiah?
Sir?
Yes, I think you talk a lot about the statutory law, and before you talk, you would rather say because it is statutory or it's the common, because two different things. You can win also in the common in the statutory court. Yeah, the John offered this court on the course on National Liberty Alliance for like $200 to $150. Either way, it's, you have to decide it yourself. Either first you have to understand either you are the plaintiff or defendant. And if you are plaintiff, you can decide the common law or the common
correct
law or the statutory. But, you know, like the everything what we're talking about is the common sense. You have to do it easier, quicker. And, you know, we talk over here and, you know, I'm losing my mind because, you know, we are going sideways instead of directly to the win.
I say we should be talking more about courtroom observing.
No, I am talking about when you talk. I assume that
you're thrown sideways.
No, when you're talking, I understand you're talking about the statutory system.
What?
And
no,
we like
not at all.
We like to talk about the common law, or when we go to the court, to defend yourself, you can defend yourself in this in the common law. You can defend yourself in the statutory court, but you know, you have to make the decision.
My goodness. Well, let me tell you something real quick. 692 of the Penal Code, sir, in California, that's a statute, right? It's criminal law, Penal Code. 692 through 694 states that anybody, any person, any man, any woman, any child can resist an unlawful public offense. You know that? And what that statute represents is the embodiment of the common law. Your right to be able to resist an unlawful public offense. You see what I'm saying? So some
we're a man or we're a woman.
That's fine. Let's not get caught up on the small things. The point of it is this, you guys. I'm in support of this group, 100% support of this group, and I can tell you from firsthand knowledge, okay, that statutes embody the common law, and that's the kind of system we have. We have a multi-jurisdictional scenario that's going on around us.
Right. Hey, Jeremiah, I am listening to the Monday night call for more than a year, every Monday. I know you, what you're talking
about. Barely
even
have time to speak on there. Thank you.
And I am behind you 100%. You know, no man can know everything. We can learn
from each other. You should call me directly. 415-215-286-2149 if you want to take my phone number down.
I got your phone number last Monday. I've written down, I got your email. If times allow, I will contact you.
Well, let's talk because I came up on some knowledge today about property tax. And it's huge. It basically has,
great.
I mean, I don't even go into detail because this is the wrong forum for it because this call is about courtroom observance. But
give your number again, Jeremiah, 415 what?
Please call me, everybody, at 415-286.
2149 to talk about the application of common law, how to apply it.
415-286-2149.
Yeah. I'm not saying I have the end-all answer, but definitely I believe that the gentleman just speaking was appropriately speaking to a genuine concern of the of the overall and people involved interested here, and that we have a consensus, right, that we need to stay focused. Let's just get back onto the common law journal societies. I mean the excuse me, the courtroom observing.
Observer.
Yeah.
Thanks, you guys. Thanks, Jeremiah.
Maybe we should have a weekly call for just common law issues and study.
That would be good. Actually, if you guys want to come on Wednesday, I can do a call on Wednesday on TalkShoe every Wednesday, and you guys are feel free to talk as much as you want to and get on there and dialogue amongst yourselves, and I'll come in and, of course, chime in. But you know TalkShoe's number. My number's 141792. My call ID number, 141792 on TalkShoe, Donaldson's Analysis.
Well, we're at the end of our hour.
Want some dessert or anything? More water?
Sir, so you're at the end of the hour?
Yeah, we're at the end of the hour.
Well, I mean, you know.
But I appreciate all the comments.
Robert?
Well, let me ask you a question about, I mean, hold on a second. Don't end the call yet. Do you have to end it?
No.
Well, the fact is I like to keep the calls in the time frame.
Okay.
So here's
the thing. We have a couple of people that seem like they're interested in dialoguing a little more. If I could interest you all in talking about paying certain care, things to watch for, again, when you go in to do courtroom observing, I'd like to take a few minutes to do that, if that's okay.
And how many minutes is that?
Oh, man, I don't know. Five?
Because I have other calls and whatnot to make, and I can't leave I can't leave the call on.
Right. Well, you know, you're providing a public service right now, and I don't want to interfere with your other services, so I totally have to agree with you that it's probably a good time to end it. I do appreciate you taking the time to give me the space to speak and not muting me. After all, I think everybody can surmise that I've been on these calls long enough to be considered a constituent of the group, right? And that I have something pretty much that I'm serious about it, you guys.
If you've got comments about courtroom observing, hang on to them until next week, and I'll give you the opportunity to go over.
Yeah. I will. Okay, I'll save my comments. But I already put my, you know, Jesus' blood is the most powerful blood, right? You already know that. But just remember, put your blood over this every single day when you put your energy into these calls. You put your blood and your intentions over it every single day, just like Jesus put his blood over his intent. And we subscribe to that, so I'm subscribing to your sacrifice, and I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Hang on to those thoughts until next week, and you'll be first up to talk about courtroom observing. All right, thank you, guys. Go ahead and close it off, Terry.
Okay.